Guardian Podcasts are partnered with audible.co.uk. For a free download, be sure to check out guardian.co.uk/audible, where Guardian listeners can choose any audiobook for free. See the page for more details.
Hello, welcome to Music Weekly. I'm Alexis Petridis.
And I'm Kieran Yates.
Coming up, Martin Talbot of the Official Charts Company celebrates 60 years of slam dunking in at number one.
We talk to 254, perhaps the least Googleable band alive.
Plus, three new tracks in Singles Club. And there's more. We've got a series of bonus podcasts starting this week, hosted by Giles Peterson.
All here on Music Weekly from The Guardian.
Joining me and Kieran this week. Kieran has new hair, which you can't see, but it is amazing. Blue. Mm. Hair is blue. Joining us this week on Music Weekly is The Guardian music editor, Tim Jones.
I thought you were going to bill Kieran's new hair as the guest.
It is the...
I'm not really worthy compared to Kieran's new hair.
How you doing?
I'm great, yes.
Excellent. What news this week? What's the news? Eurovision.
Eurovision,
I'm
yes.
still so excited about Eurovision.
Why are you so excited? I thought it was far from a vintage year.
I just thought it was great. I thought Jedward were great. I thought the Russian grannies were great.
Russian grannies were great.
I liked all the kind of, you know, land of oil, land of fun kind of videos.
And they had City of Lights. Yeah. I liked the woman from Albania that was like a sort of more moribund version of Bjork. I thought she was good. And the weird kind of hair.
See,
sort of hair necklace.
Half.
Oh, the dreadlock for the necklace. Oh, God, that made me really vomit.
I followed the first half on Twitter because I was watching the most boring football match of all time, England versus Norway. But watching it on Twitter, it made it sound like a lot more fun than it actually was when I went back and saw it.
I went to bed before the results came in. I got to about 10:30 and I was knackered and, let's be honest, drunk. And I thought, you know, I can't be bothered. It's just that I think one of the problems with Eurovision is the balance is all wrong because all the songs were over by 9:30. Yeah. And then you look at that, another 2 hours of people going, you know, Belgrade calling, we have your votes. Thank you for an amazing show. You know, and that's just boring.
Did you play a Eurovision drinking game?
No, I'm just, to all intents and purposes, an alcoholic.
Oh, darling, right, okay, right.
I was sat on my own, you know. What are we going to do? What's England going to do? Because it can't carry on like this.
No.
Britain, rather. Great Britain. United Kingdom. Royaume-Uni.
But why don't they actually...
Does
anyone care? Do we care?
Could pick someone to represent the UK.
Well, the song that won was, you know, a pretty decent and modern sounding song.
It was like some off the charts,
if you came up with that, you were British, just to be fair, you would not think ever about putting it into Eurovision. You'd think about having a chart.
That's the thing, isn't it? You can't think of anybody of any credibility that would do it. And I think the thing is, you've got to do it straight. There's no point in doing this kind of Eurovision raised eyebrow thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because they're not, you know, people from Azerbaijan and stuff like that, they're not, you know, you turn up and you take the piss. This is like the biggest deal ever. They've completely renovated their entire country, you know. And if you turn up and go, scooch, then...
Yeah, you couldn't send them
examples,
could you?
But you don't need...
Could send them examples.
You just need someone who's unknown, don't you?
I think.
A good song, someone who no one's ever heard of. It doesn't matter if you've heard of them.
No, true. No one had heard of Brother the Man, had they? Robbie Williams at his peak would have been very good for Eurovision. If I can't raise any interest in Eurovision, I'm sure we're all looking forward to the Jubilee concert on Monday.
Yeah, I can't wait. I'm live blogging it.
Are you? Mm. I'm there, mate.
You're there?
I'm there.
Oh, yeah, you'll be feeding me back tidbits of gossip.
Yeah, I'm not like backstage. I'm not sort of glad-handing Ed Sheeran, but I'm there. Who are you looking forward to the most?
Gary.
Who's on last?
Is it Macca or Elton? He's on last. It's got to be one of either Macca. I think Macca trumps Elton, doesn't he?
Right, you'd hope so.
Who are the young people that are on? Jessie J?
Yeah.
Ed Sheeran?
Yeah, I haven't really.
I heard Madness were performing on top of Buckingham Palace.
Really? Mm.
That's what Elton told
me. I don't think
me.
That's true.
Well, that's what Elton
that
It'd
true?
Be amazing. Imagine if they did our house. Palace. That would be amazing. Or House of Fun. That'd be House of Fun.
That
amazing.
Would be great.
A song about condoms. anyway, that's the. I don't think there's anything much happening at the moment, is there? News wise,
not much.
Apart from Eurovision and the Jubilee. Mm-hmm. You may not have heard of 254, but then having a numerical title for your band isn't particularly internet friendly. Nevertheless, 254 are Colette and Hannah Thurlow, and their self-released songs excited Alan Moulder and Rob Ellis enough to record 254's debut album. Wow, big production names for a debut album. The Guardian's Rebecca Nicholson thought it was time to meet them.
Named after a moment in a Melvin song. What song is that? And can you tell me what that moment sounds like? Not necessarily an impression, but you can if you like.
It's from A History of Bad Men, and I guess it's like there's a big choral build-up, and then it drops into this incredible doomy bass line, and it just sounds quite trippy.
And no concerns about the kind of Googleability of having a numeric name?
I guess we never really thought about it.
Yeah.
Probably should have.
Yeah, we never really thought about the kind of...
I guess that's not a very rock and roll thing for the checklist, is it?
Like, yeah.
How's our SEO? All that kind of stuff. In the beginning, in the very beginning, you two were in a different band together, Vulgarians. Was that the first time you'd made music together? Was it the first time you'd been in bands?
Yeah, it was kind of the only band we've been in. Yeah, just like your first band kind of experience. We only played like a handful of shows. It was very just kind of very fast punk songs.
Yeah, just DIY really.
Yeah,
and I guess it sort of ignited something in us in terms of playing live and things like that. So it was definitely important in the beginning.
And why the kind of move away from that sound? Was it just something that you got out of your system, or, you know, how did it evolve into what this is now?
Just kind of expired naturally, just kind of ran its course. And then some time passed, and then Hannah started writing more like meditative pieces of music, just longer and different, just a different sound. And we just sort of just went with it, really, trying to write songs that were longer than 1.5 minutes. You know? That was kind of...
Yeah. And when did you first notice people paying attention to 254? Has it been a couple of years now that you've been playing?
Yeah.
When we made Creeping and then put that online, it all sprang from there, really. And that got attention, and we could never have anticipated that ever. We were just really into the song. And I guess, that's just, that was the origin, really.
And you worked with Rob Ellis. Were you aware of his work before and the things that he had done before that? Is that partly why you wanted to work with him?
Yeah, I mean, it has an incredible heritage in music, and we're huge fans. So it was a privilege to be working with him. Yeah, I mean, after the B-sides for the Scarlet EP, it just seemed like a natural, fitting choice to work with him for the main body of the album. Yeah. So,
and what do you think he specifically brought to the album? What kind of thing did he contribute?
He just has a great kind of knowledge of kind of how to capture the sounds in the studio,
and he's a drummer, sorry to interrupt.
He's a drummer,
has this incredible, like, the drum style of the album is amazing.
Obviously neither of you are drummers, so you might be biased about this, but a lot of people say that the drummer is actually the most important member of the band in a lot of situations. Do you think that's true?
Hannah's a pretty badass drummer.
Not the same lead as Alex at all. I think it's very important to have somebody keeping the main
heart
rhythm,
heartbeat
of every song.
The boys are incredible. Like, Alex and Joel, just and to have met them so early on as well, just incredible players and beautiful boys to be around, you know?
Yeah. At what stage did they come on board with everything?
Fairly early on, because we never wanted to become a duo live. We always...
Yeah, practically, I imagine it's difficult.
Yeah. We're trying to play. but we just wanted the songs to kind of reach their full potential.
Were you ever kind of wary of signing to a major label, or did that feel like a fairly natural thing to do? Are there any restrictions that you don't think you would have experienced on an indie, that kind of thing?
Fiction doesn't feel major label-y at all, and we fell in love with the team and the roster as well. So it was just, it's been an incredible experience, you know. Yeah.
Yeah. So that must be nice then, going from, as you said, Bulgarians is very DIY, so it hasn't been too much of a jarring transition.
No, not at all. It's just been really positive. And, yeah. You know, we're learning all the time, so it's just been...
Mm-hmm. And live, I saw you play very briefly in Texas and then in Leeds, and it seemed to me that there was a massive difference in your kind of confidence and stage presence, even in that short time. Do you think that's something that's happened? Is it something that's developed? Or
I think it's constantly developing. Confidence is a funny thing, you know, sometimes it just disappears, you know. But I think also, I think there was something about playing our own headline shows and having people who were coming to see us specifically that really changed the dynamic for us on stage, you know. So, yeah, but it's an ongoing process.
Right. So what happens next? What's the next stage, with live-wise?
Well, yeah, we're playing the Scala in June.
It's exciting. It's big, the Scala.
Yeah.
It's very, very, very big.
So yeah, just kind of working towards that, and then we're going to America for 3 weeks.
Oh wow.
Which will be, just an adventure.
That was Rebecca Nicholson talking to 254, and the album, also called 254, is out now on Fiction. Time for Singles Club. Tim, let's listen to your offering.
First of all, you're the type of woman that stays on my mind. Walk down the street, every guy wanna jump on your behind. It's your seduction that makes sure that we stay in line. Sexual corruption, cause I'll kill anyone for your time.
P Square with Chop My Money featuring Akon and May D. Tim, your choice.
Yeah, you look like you love that, Alexis.
Absolutely dreadful.
I have to say it's been around a long time. I'm very late on this. But it seems to be flying up the iTunes world chart.
Okay.
And there's a lot of kind of talk about Afrobeats and Nigerian and Ghanaian.
Is that an example of Nigerian?
Yeah, I think it comes
Ghanaian.
Under the umbrella.
Yeah, it's not one of the best examples. But yeah,
haters gonna hate him. Carry on.
It's basically all I've been listening to all week, over and over on repeat. It's like, because there's like a melodic hook on every section of the song.
It sounded really tinny.
Oh, it's ridiculous! It's a ridiculous cheesy song.
It is.
I'm not here claiming this is great art.
Is that what you're doing when you're at your desk, just singing about Big Behinds?
Literally all week. I've played this like 20 times every day.
What does Chop My Money mean?
I don't even know. I was trying to work that out. What does it mean?
I don't know. I thought it was like taking his money. Like a girl chopping his money.
Chopping money.
But he's jumping on her behind.
No, everybody's jumping on her behind. Everybody, right. When she walks down the street, everybody jumps on her behind. Wants to.
And it's like, God, get off her behind.
Get off her behind, man.
Yeah.
Do you not just think it's a great song?
No. I don't. No, I think I just think it sounds very tinny. It's kind of annoying. The tune is annoying.
They go wild for this in Lagos.
I'm sure they do. God
this
bless
is really
them.
Huge.
You know,
really
good
big.
Luck to good luck to them. This is massive. Karen, do you can you fill me in as Craig?
Yeah.
Davis
so these
said?
They're twins, aren't they? They're two guys. I forget their names. And they're really popular. P Square, really big. And there's loads of these. Kind
what
of
are
characters.
They from? Are they from Lagos?
Nigeria. They're from
Nigeria.
Nigeria somewhere.
Right.
Sure.
Okay.
Akon recently kind of signed. He signed three. Afrobeats artist into it.
So a lot of this going
Wizkid,
on, isn't there?
Debanj.
Debanj, yeah, I've come across Debanj.
Yes, and Wizkid is playing a show on Monday, which we should all go to.
I'm fed up at the Jubilee concert, enjoying Jessie J.
I'll be skanking.
So will I. What do you call it?
Loads of these really great characters in Afrobeats. There's like Sarkodie, which I don't know if I'm pronouncing right, and he's like the fastest spitter in Nigeria.
Wow, you
know, like
that's pretty cool.
Nigerian twister. And then, yeah, these twins who are, like, you know, huge and kind of Wizkid, he's, like, the young guy who kind of Akon's kind of taken under his wing. And, yeah, all of these lot, they're pretty good. I mean, I'm not really a fan of Akon.
Do you like this song? Do I get any backup from you?
No, I quite like the chorus. I don't like Akon on it. I don't like the video. He tries to make, like, dough and more rhyme, and it's like, it doesn't rhyme. Give up, Akon.
Well, you know, you can get away with it. It's like that, those co-op adverts, isn't it? Good and food don't rhyme unless you're Scottish. Good with food. Dough and mo.
I didn't think we'd be comparing that to the co-op advert. You've really kind of.
Kieran, you said this is not a particularly great example.
No, I don't think so.
Does the other stuff sound a bit meatier? Does it
sound
a bit?
Yeah, it does. Kind of interesting because, you know, it doesn't. Afrobeats traditionally doesn't have that kind of, you know, sexual stuff in the same way as like Bashment and Dancehall have. Mm-hmm. You know, you wouldn't like dagger to Afrobeats. It's, you know,
I wouldn't dagger to anything, darling. I'm 40 years old, but anyway, carry on.
Oh, okay. You're not living, Alexis.
I've got two children.
That's how you got them. Anyway.
I assure you it wasn't.
Anyway, but yeah, no, I like Afrobeats. Kind of sonically, it's a, you know, it's a slightly more conservative than kind of Bashment and Dancehall, but it's really fun and it's, you know, it's very young. It's very kind of tween audience.
Yeah, you could see it sounds that way, actually. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Mm. Okay, well, there you go. P Square, Chop My Money, featuring Akon and May D. Is it a roundabout on the internet?
Yeah,
and,
obviously, yeah.
Right, next up, Kieran's choice. That's the royalty back to 1999. Why you'd want to go back to 1999, I've no idea. Back to 1999 remix of Cheryl Cole's Call My Name. Kieran's choice.
Yeah, that is Royalty remix. Royalty is a 21-year-old grime producer, kind of first and foremost, and this is sort of a move away from that, obviously a little bit more garage-influenced. But yeah, he's, you know, kind of very well known in the grime scene for doing lots of great productions. He released Orangeade last year on Butters, which was a really massive club track. It was played in all the grime raves and it was everywhere. And he's kind of well known for that. He's done a remix of this sort of underground female vocalist called
Cheryl Cole.
Cheryl Cole. And I mean, you know, and I think that like this is brilliant. I mean, I'm not a fan of Cheryl Cole.
What, generally, as a singer?
Yeah,
just... As a person? Because I've met her and she's amazing.
Really, yeah. I don't like her music at all. It's not kind of feisty enough or something, you know? It seems a little bit kind of wooden and a little bit boring. There's kind of a blandness to her, even though she's kind of obviously wants to be quite upbeat. But this, like, he's kind of transformed it and it sounds like, yeah, sounds like... You know, Garage sounds like all the best bits of Garage. It sounds like...
It definitely reminds me of that. I can see why it's back to 19.
That sweet female attitude.
Sweet female attitude, flowers and records like that, which was the sort of end of that sort of music that I preferred, actually, rather than, say, that dreadful, do you really like it? It's one of those records that you look back on, why didn't anybody buy that? It's bloody awful.
Yeah,
you know?
More Tina Moore than DJ.
Yeah, Arch. No, Tina Moore, or that kind of thing. Love Shy by Kirsten Blonde.
Yeah.
Tim.
I was going to ask Kieran, actually, because Royalty is so connected with grime,
yeah.
Is this just really signifying that grime is getting a lot lighter? and more colourful and playful, because I've listened to quite a bit of his stuff, and it all sounds like, yeah, just like colourful early rave music or garage.
Okay, yeah.
And to me, a lot of the stuff that I'm hearing I wouldn't even associate with grime at all.
I think a lot of that is, though, because people don't generally listen to grime instrumentals on their own, and so you always associate grime with those really hard vocals. And kind of when you're in a rave, there definitely is that. But of course, a lot of it is listening to instrumentals, you know, before MCs come on stage or, you know, when the DJ's in the booth. And so this, to me, you know, it's got a sense of that grime flavour. He kind of always describes grime as Garage's, you know, naughty younger brother. And so I think that there's always been kind of a sonic connection there. It does feel lighter, doesn't it? It feels like lighter.
It feels very light. But actually, I think one of the things that makes it light, it's quite weird because Calvin Harris did the original, and I think it's a good song. I actually quite like Calvin Harris. And I think why is basically the original has all these bludgeoning Eurotrance synths. Amazingly.
Like every record.
But Calvin Harris seems, they're slightly syncopated. And do you know what I mean? There's a slight swing to...
Yeah, I know what you mean.
And that comes, I think, from him being immersed in UK dance culture rather than UK, US VIP pop.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's true. But that's why I think this fits so well here, to me, personally. I just think the song has a little skip to it, which was in the original.
Enables him to remix it in that way. I agree. I think it's a really good remix. It's a very hip person for Cheryl Cole to commission to do a remix, or Cheryl Cole's people.
What, Calvin Harris?
yeah. Underground dance producer. Probably haven't heard of him.
Came up with that idea to get Calvin Harris.
I know, it's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is Will I Am on the album as well? I don't know. I think it's good. Around and About on the internet. I don't know how I bother asking. Basically, take it as read that everything on Singles Club is available for illegal download somewhere. Is this going to be released, do you think? Does anything get released these days? I don't know. Moving on, my choice. Listening back to that, I actually think it's quite annoying. In fairness, that's Blood Diamonds featuring Grimes, and that's called Phone Sex. Blood Diamonds is an LA sort of pop, you know, one of these guys that's a pop producer, but he's obviously not a pop producer. He's like an indie bloke with specs, he's got a synthesizer.
7 foot tall.
Is he?
Nearly. As tall as a fridge, he says.
Really?
Yeah.
I'll be minding my P's and Q's about him in that case. I actually really like the bit that I liked about it is I like the sort of main riff, which you heard a tiny little bit of there, the sort of steel drum kind of thing going on in it. I think that bit, which is obviously meant to be influenced by K-pop or J-pop or whatever, some sort of, you know, Far Eastern pop thing, I think it's a tiny little bit craven. I think the sort of Ickle Girl vocal, I understand that's what K-pop is like, but I think you could actually have that melody without doing a kind of Ickle Girl kind of voice on it. You know, Grimes doesn't. She doesn't have to sing like that. You know, she doesn't sing like that. However, I think it's a good song. I think it's an interesting record. It's coming out on 4AD, as everything appears to come out on 4AD these days, in July. And I throw it open to the panel. It was beginning with Tim.
What I thought was quite interesting is back in the day, you had mainstream artists looking underground to see what was going on and then ripping off a bit. But this, to me, sounds a bit like they've listened to Rihanna's We Found Love and made a hipster version of it.
Yeah, there is that, isn't there? I put on an album this morning by a band who shall remain nameless, but they're signed to a venerable indie label, and they've kind of reconfigured their sound, and, you know, they were sort of a guitar band, and they've gone, it's all like synthesizers and autotune vocals and da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and it's like, well, I don't know why you're doing this. I don't really know why. You know, it's not like there isn't enough of this music in the world already. And you're probably not going to make a record as good as We Found Love by Rihanna or something like that. So, you know, I'm really talking myself out of this, aren't I? But I think this is actually a better record. I think it's a good song. Kieran?
Yeah, I feel the same as you. I liked all that steel drum stuff, but the more instrumental thing. I think that, the point that you make about it not working so much in this sort of almost ballady, lo-fi type thing doesn't work so well. It sounds like a really muted Cyndi Lauper or something. It doesn't really
work. Yeah, I know what you mean, yeah.
I can deal with that, you know, I can deal with the sort of Joanna Newsom, Coco Rosie kind of squeaky little girl thing when they're being a little bit more melancholic. But generally when I hear this, I like it to sound more energetic and K-pop-y. So I wasn't overgone on her voice, but yeah, I could listen to the instrumental of it, I think.
Well, there you go. you're equivocal, I'm equivocal. That's Blood Diamonds featuring Grimes, Phone Sex, which is out in July, I believe.
Time for a couple of thoughts posted on the Music Weekly thread after last week's podcast.
Dave Porcivo, a regular correspondent, writes, on Poppy and the Jezebels, I'm massively with Alexis. Thank you, Dave. Partly because I love silly girly pop, but mostly because I love simplistic music. What's wrong with sounding effortless, easy and brainless? Sounding studious... well, you know...
That's one for their little sticker on the CD.
Sounding studious, laboured and intellectual might imbue some kind of worthiness, but 9 times out of 10 you'll end up with something like Bitter Orca by Dirty Projectors or anything by Gang Gang Dance.
On the subject of English folk music, Joe Keehy says, it's a shame that the deserved praise for Sandy Denny was, with depressing inevitability, followed by a rubbishing of post-Denny Fairport convention. Many fine songwriters have lent their talents to the band over the years, and multi-instrumentalist Chris Leslie is currently doing a great job in that department. I will proudly be drinking real ale through my beard in August for the 4th year in a row at their Crop Ready Festival.
It would be amazing if you were. If you were actually saying that.
That would be brilliant.
It's meant to be brilliant, Crop Ready, actually. It's meant to be a tremendously good fun.
Yeah.
Very family friendly.
Sounds it. From that.
Family friendly.
Well, you know. Brilliant. Matters to me, darling, these days, that kind of thing. Anyway.
Can you dagger there?
Can I dagger that? I don't dagger anywhere. Hang on to your bunting. Because it's not just the Queen's Jubilee this weekend. Something else that has reigned over the UK for 60 years is the official singles chart. The Guardian's Full Music section is celebrating this with a story of 60 great number one tracks. So we thought we would speak to Martin Talbot, Managing Director of the Official Charts Company. Casper Llewellyn-Smith began by asking Martin to give a potted history of the British pop chart.
Yeah, the official singles chart first launched back in 1952. I mean, the very first singles chart in the UK was actually compiled for the New Musical Express. And a guy called Percy Dickens, who was the publisher of the newspaper, decided that a really good way of getting people to advertise in the paper would be to create a chart of the biggest selling singles of the moment. He got the idea from the States, I think, because in America, Billboard first launched charts, well, the singles chart in particular, just a few years before that. I mean, they'd been doing sheet music charts for many decades, but they launched a singles chart because it was this brand new format that had only been launched 2 or 3 years before. And Percy Dickens looked at it and just thought, well, actually, you know what, if I can call around a few shops... Oh, we could do a little list of the biggest selling singles of the moment and maybe some of the labels will advertise in my newspaper. And lo and behold, that's what he did. I mean, it was a very, very basic thing at that point. And the first week, the first chart, kind of bizarrely, was a top 12 with 14 records in it. Because there were a few that kind of had exactly the same number of sales, because obviously he was only calling a few record shops. So there were dead heats throughout the chart.
And what was the first number one smash hit?
The first number one was a record called Here in My Heart by Al Martino, who famously, of course, later appeared in one of the Godfather movies as a crooner. And he was basically a crooner. And this was, you know, pre-rock and roll. And the first few years of the chart were really dominated by that kind of music. It was only in the mid-50s, you know, the first really, really big rock and roll hit that came through was Rock Around the Clock by Bill Haley, which in fact was the first million seller in the UK as well.
What was the big thing that changed the fortunes of the chart? I mean, suddenly the point at which everyone starts paying attention to it and it becomes this quite a central part of British life. I mean, everyone growing up over the age of... Well, probably 50, it feels like it's been, you know, something they've followed all their life or got a sense of it anyway.
Yeah, I mean, the first use of any kind of chart on within broadcast was on radio. You know, the Light program had they launched a show called Pick of the Pops, which actually is back these days on Radio 2. But you know, that was the first real chart show. But I think the most important moment was you know, the launch of Top of the Pops in 1964. Bill Cotton, who at that point was you know, a very important person within the BBC, was casting around looking for ideas for programming which potentially could broaden the audience for television. And there was very little stuff for teenagers in particular, and he kind of cast around and saw that there was this thing that was going on. You know, the kids were buying these singles. The singles market was a very kind of teen orientated thing, and it was a bit of a mystery to the adults as well. So it kind of gave it a bit of cachet. But that was, you know, the single most important moment. And you know, that's one of the reasons why the BBC now has this amazing archive of recordings. You know, from the early to mid 60s all the way through to the noughties. I mean, it's an incredibly important television programme. And I think the other thing about it as well is it took the chart and it piped it into people's homes every week. So it became part of the kind of natural conversation which took place between parents and their kids. And, you know, before water coolers, it was the kind of thing that you'd talk about over the water cooler.
What point did a canonical chart develop? I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but in the early days, weren't there several charts? Because it wasn't simply the enemy. Other people started doing compiling records. And then, you know, it's the Diamond Jubilee this weekend. You think back to the Jubilee in 1977, and there's the famous incident with the Sex Pistols and whether or not their record goes to number one. And it's, you know, officially they don't, but there's a sense that in another chart that they have.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in the 50s, there were a range of different music magazines. I mean, not just the NME, there was a Melody Maker, there was a magazine called, a newspaper called Disc as well, Record Retailer. And over a period of kind of, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years, they all launched their own singles charts, and they were all trying to one-up each other. So having said that, whenever we talk about those charts, as far as we're concerned, the NME chart from 52 until 60 is the official chart. That was the one that most people paid most attention to. It was the most important one because it was the first. And likewise from 60 onwards, and then from 1969.
So tell me how the charts changed, say, in the mid-1990s when sales slumped, and then after that you have the death of Top of the Pops. And I mean, I said earlier that there's a sense of every generation has grown up since the war, the charts are an important part of their lives. Now partly it's a function of getting older that you don't know what's at the top of the charts anymore, but partly it felt that the charts became less important and they lost that kind of hold on the national psyche to some extent.
Yeah, I think it's one of the challenges that the chart has, probably over and above anything else, is maintaining the sense that this is important and this reflects proper sales and genuinely what people are buying. And it becomes difficult when the population is so polarised. You know, it's actually not dissimilar to the situation that we had in the 1960s in that, you know, if you talk to anybody over the age of 25 and ask them if they know who Carly Rae Jepsen is or Rita Ora or DJ Fresh or Cover Drive, all of whom have had number ones this year, they'll look at you askance and wonder what on earth you're talking about. If you ask anybody under the age of 18, 19, 20, they'll look at you askance because they can't believe you don't know who these people are. You know, there's a real division now between the singles chart and the albums chart more than there has been for a long, long time. So the albums chart is very much more mature. I mean, this year, you know, the kind of people who've been number one in that have been, you know, Bruce Springsteen, Paul Weller, obviously Adele, you know, Ed Sheeran, Lana Del Rey, a lot of artists to appeal to a slightly older audience. I mean, the other thing we constantly battle over is communicating to people and making people aware that actually the single is going through an incredible boom time at the moment. It's had its troughs, and there's no doubt about that. And it was one of the reasons why I think Top of the Pops was cancelled back in the kind of mid-noughties. In 2004, that was the first year of digital downloading legitimately in this country. It was the year that iTunes launched. It was the year that 7Digital launched. Coca-Cola launched their own download store as well. So everybody was kind of rushing in there. At that point, physical sales of singles had absolutely fallen through the floor. So you were talking about something like 35 million singles being sold in 1 year in 2003-2004. When you think the peak year for singles prior to that had been kind of 1978-79, when there were about 90 million singles sold, obviously that's a very big decline. But since then, we've seen what they call a hockey stick. I mean, it's just gone. The number of downloads that are being sold and being bought now have gone through the roof. In 2011, there were 178 million singles sold in the UK. We're expecting that to be over 180 million this year. When you think the biggest year for singles prior to digital was 90 million in the late 70s, that's an amazing turnaround. A lot of that, obviously, are unbundled tracks from albums. The way people consume music digitally now is very different to the way they used to consume it physically. But even taking that into account, in the last 5 years alone, you know, to get to number one, the number you need to get to number one has doubled from about 50,000 in 2004 to about 100,000 over the last 2 years. Each of the last 2 years, that's been pretty steady.
What was the first single you ever bought?
The first single I ever bought was the Ying Tong song by the Goons, with "I'm Walking Backwards for Christmas" on the B side. It was the reissue. It was 1973, so it wasn't before that. I'm not that old.
Do you know what the number one single at the moment is?
You know what? I don't, because actually, what is number one at the moment for us is different to what is number one for everybody else, because effectively, as we go through the week, we're tracking the sales as they come through. So we get sales. So we have a chart which comes out on a Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and then we have the final chart on a Sunday. And we're going to have a new entry this Sunday. Rudimental featuring John Newman is going to be the number one on Sunday. They're quite a way ahead.
Are you allowed to tell us that at this point?
I can probably tell you that at this point. I mean, obviously, there is still, at this point, by the time people listen to this, there'll be a couple of days sales still to go. We poll until, and we're one of the fastest charts in the world, so we poll until midnight on a Saturday night, and then the chart is unveiled to the world at around 1 o'clock on Sunday. And then it's published to radio listeners, to Radio 1, up until 7 o'clock on Sunday.
And for you, and talking of number one hit songs that have been number one over the course of the last 60 years, is there one number one hit that to you is the kind of platonic ideal, something which is the quintessential number one hit single in the UK?
My own favourite number one of all time is probably Don't You Want Me by the Human League. And although having said that, you know, actually we've just completed a book which is coming out later this year called The Million Sellers, which is going to collect together the stories behind. There's been 120 million sellers so far in UK history, and it's going to collect all the stories behind it. And actually, as you go through it, you know, Tainted Love is an amazing record, and Hit Me With Your Rhythm Stick is an amazing record, and so on and so on. I mean, I've just probably given away my age there by choosing three.
Presumably someone who is slightly older than you will be saying Joe Stafford from 1953 is an amazing record, or Winifred Atwell, and someone who's sort of seven years old will be saying the best record ever is by Rita Ora.
Absolutely. And you know what? You know, it's one of the things that we're spending a lot of time and effort on at the moment, is trying to bring attention to the fact that, you know, if the kids who go out, you know, this week and, you know, buy the Rudimental single, for instance, and get that to number one perhaps on Sunday, that's absolutely equivalent to me going out and buying Don't You Want Me in 1981, or somebody going out to buy, you know, Release Me by Engelbert Humperdinck in 1967, or Al Martino in 1952. It's all part of the same thing. We've effectively all been influencing the chart in the same way. And there is this amazing heritage. I mean, you know, it's not only our 60th anniversary this year, it's obviously the 60th anniversary of the Queen. It's strange when you think about it that you know, we've chronicled that entire six-decade period. There's hardly anything else like it, actually, I think, that kind of connects culturally where we are now, right the way back over six decades.
That's Caspar Llewellyn-Smith talking to Martin Talbot of the Official Charts Company. Yes. Do people still care about the charts? He's saying they do.
Yes, I think they do.
Yes.
You think they do? I mean, you're a younger person.
Yeah. Rudimental are number one in the
I know, amazing. Friends of the Pod. That?
Yeah.
How fantastic is that?
Brilliant.
Great, I'm very pleased to hear it. If you had to pick a number one from throughout these 60 years of the charts, what would you pick as your favourite?
Well, my favourite records are number ones. ABBA, Dancing Queen.
Yep.
Come On Eileen, Dexys Midnight Runners.
Oh, Jesus.
Deeply Dippy. Right,
Deeply Dippy was a great record.
You know? Number ones, you look through the history number ones and
there's some amazing stuff in there. There's also records that were number one, particularly around sort of like 2000. No record, things by A1 and stuff like that, they've just had a no idea what this sounds like. Was this number one really? You know, bizarre. Kieran, what would you pick?
I liked Wannabe a lot, obviously.
Yeah.
Call Me Bad, I Wanna Sex You Up, because I wasn't allowed to sing that.
Really?
Yeah. I had to go,
wow.
I wanna
sex you up.
That's the thing, I think, you when you pick your favourite number one, you don't really pick your favourite record that got to number one. Because my instinct was to pick Stay Another Day by E17. Just because that's what I remember being a number one. And yeah, all my memories are associated with it while it was at the top.
Yeah, I think the first number one I remember actually being number one is Dancing Queen by ABBA when I was about five.
Okay.
But I don't know, I wonder, I just sort of think, I thought, and maybe I'm completely wrong, maybe it's a function of my age, that there used to be a real potent thing about being number one. And that was true throughout my sort of youth. And was true even, you know, early 90s, you had these sort of, you know, Bryan Adams being number one like forever and stuff like that. And there seemed to come a point in at some point in the noughties where it ceased to matter what was number one. Perhaps it just ceased to matter to me, I don't know.
I think it's a bit of that. I think it's a bit of getting older. But I do think, obviously, there's so many more outlets for music now, so that, you know, you don't get your family or even yourself gathering around a radio.
Well, here's an interesting thing. How times have changed. Somebody sent me a recording of the Radio 1 chart rundown. I'm not making this up. This isn't from, like, 1932, as it said. 1976. Have a listen to this.
Single Bed, the new entry from Fox. And Isaac Hayes has a new entry at
number 17.
That's what youth culture. That's why that there you are. That's why punk happened. I think if I had to pick a number one, my favourite number one record is probably "Mouldy Old Dough" by Lieutenant Pigeon, which was number one in 1972. It's just an incredible record. If you've never seen a photo of Lieutenant Pigeon, go and Google a picture of Lieutenant Pigeon, because it's the most remarkable looking. But it's the kind of thing that would only happen in England. And the record itself is this sort of horrible, kind of diseased, maggoty sounding instrumental. It sounds the way the 1970s looked. You know, you see footage of the 1970s and it just looks awful. Mouldy Old Dough, which was made by, I think, some people from either Birmingham or Wolverhampton, in their front room. It was their only hit. Well, they had a follow-up called Desperate Damage, wasn't very big. And it's just a sort of amazing, weird, one-off record that tells you a lot about Britain, I think, in 1972. It tells you more about Britain in 1972 than any sort of glam rock record does.
What people were buying back then as well was the best indicator of what was popular that week, whereas now, that's not the case, is it?
In what sense? I don't understand what you
mean. Well, there's so many other ways a song can be popular, and it's not judged on sales. You were talking about, like, how if it has the same potency these days.
Yeah, that's true. I suppose something can be a massive YouTube hit and therefore be a big deal. Though clearly, do you think they'll be with us forevermore, the charts? I think people will, you know, it's certainly become a more, as you say, it's become a more diffuse world, as Tim says, and there are other ways of expressing your love of a record rather than actually buying it in a weird way.
The American charts themselves have always been based on radio play and that build, haven't they? So there's, I guess you could incorporate all kinds of viral factors into.
And it's still a great way to quantify success, isn't it? In a way that it's not quite as potent as a YouTube video or something going viral. I think there's still something behind that. And
I actually think it's got better since it became like the download.
I saw the independent charts yesterday.
Just remarkable. I saw that tweet you sent. That was amazing.
It was like, so what was on there? It was like, obviously, loads of Adele, which kind of makes sense.
Number seven was Seven Nation Army, by the way.
There were some cover versions of, like, indie hits, like karaoke versions.
Wow. They're apparently doing streaming charts now for things like Spotify. Which is interesting.
On those, it's always good, isn't it, when there's been like an episode of Glee,
And
there's been a song on it, and the next day,
I think Damien Rice's Cannonball or something, has just gone rocketing back into the Billboard charts because it was on the US version of The Voice. Or something
I quite like it when those.
No, I think totally random kind of records get in the chart. I think the sort of diversity of the chart. The only thing I don't like is this thing of records hanging around like forever. You know, I mean, it's nothing against Ed Sheeran at all. He's a dear. you know, that A Team was in the chart forever, you know.
Clinging on for dear life.
Clinging on, but you know, as you say, it is an indicator of what people like. There you go. That's what a brilliant, on that brilliant conclusion about the charts. Well, last but not in any way least, some news about our bonus podcast, you lucky people. This week sees the launch of Guardian Music's Sounds of Europe series, as a part of which the lovely Giles Peterson came in to tell us about some of his favourite bits of continental music. Menomina. Once you've listened to this, be sure to go onto the Guardian Music site and check out Giles' top three French tracks, from Chanteur Classic to Dance Floor Bangueur. Same time and same place next week. Leave your thoughts at guardian.co.uk/musicweekly. Have a great Jubilee weekend. Bye-bye.
Guardian podcasts are partnered with audible.co.uk. For a free download, be sure to check out guardian.co.uk/audible, where Guardian listeners can choose any audiobook for free. See the page for more details.